on Sunday, October 16th at 11 p.m., Sugar My Bowl presents composer, saxophonist, flautist, Jane Burnett. Join us as we discuss Jane Burnett's career and her most recent project with Makeke. That's Sunday, October 16th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is Jane Burnett. She has a new project, Jane Burnett and Makeke. Their latest release is called Odara, and for a pledge of $35, you can get this CD and help WBAI in the process by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-626-3602. Or go to give the number 2 WBAI.org. That's give the number 2 WBAI.org. Sugar and My Bowl coming up now.
Fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
problema.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Jane Bennett.
Jane Bennett, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Thank you.
We're really glad to have you on.
Beautiful.
Your birthday's coming up, as a matter of fact. It's next Saturday.
Indeed. Let's not talk about my birthday. I don't do it very gracefully. Gracefully, either.
Well, I just noticed in doing my homework that it's coming up. But what I heard from another interview, your mother, Mary, she described you as being, in three words, determined, impish, and challenging.
Really? How dare she?
So why would she say such a thing?
I really don't know. She obviously doesn't know what she was talking about. Or what daughter. I think that's her oldest daughter, not me.
Well, it was also stated during that interview that you got into a little bit of trouble in school.
Yeah, I mean, and in some ways I think it's what's kind of saved me was that I've never taken no for an answer. And, you know, to do certain things from the get-go of doing our very first record in Cuba, which was 1990, Spirits of Havana, that record was about a good 3 years cutting through red tape in Cuba, getting the group Yoruba Ndabo, which is pretty well-known Rumba folkloric group now.
Yes, yes.
But at the time they were dock workers and they weren't allowed to go into the recording studio because in Cuba everybody has an identity card and they were registered as dock workers, not as musicians. This was a challenge to get that. Mercedes Valdez was the one who worked so hard on that.
And the vocalist.
Yeah, late great Mercedes. Oh my goodness, there was just so many things that, you know, if we had just been easily challenged and said, okay, I'm not up for this fight. It's been a fight. It gets tiring sometimes because I'd like to be soft and fuzzy instead of hard and thorny. But you have to really fight for it. And even this record, I think it was 5 or 6 weeks before it was to be recorded. The studio was booked. There was like Gonzalo Rubalcaba booked for the recording, Frank Emilio, Hilario Duran. There was a cast of like 22 musicians, Mercedes, a lot of people involved. And I found out just offhandedly by calling the production company, which was at the time CBC, that the project was not going to go ahead. It was a simple conversation with the secretary of one of the big suits in the corporation that said, yeah, I don't think we're going to do that project. I heard that like 5-6 weeks before we were to leave for Cuba, everything prepared. I was like, you know, I cannot show my face in front of any of these people again. They have our word that we're doing this. Everybody's worked so hard and be damned, it's going to happen. And I went to the CBC because the engineer who was coming down, he was like, oh, well, it's not happening, and moved on to the next project. And I was like so mad. I was so angry. And I went to the CBC, and nowadays you can't do that. They've got security. I couldn't get in the doors if I went now. But in those days, I went and I took myself up to the fifth floor and I went into the guy's office and I basically said, look, blankety blank, we're doing this. I can never go back to Cuba again. I've spent the last 3 years of my own money going down there preparing for this. You said you were doing it. Give me one good reason why it's now not happening, and we got the project back on. So I remember one of the things that my mom has always said to me, that I was always insistent as a kid. I would just insist on what I wanted. I'm just basically trying to get my own way. And I would just like eat at her and eat at her. Please, 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 please. And beg and please. And you gotta let me. And you gotta, I gotta. And finally, in the end, I just wore down. And she's okay. And I remember my next door neighbor who at the time was about 90 years old. And she was a real voice of wisdom in our family, and she would say to my mother, you've just listened to Janie for an hour. You've been telling her no for an hour, and now you give in to her? I learned a huge lesson from that. And, I mean, sometimes I guess it can really piss people off because I am passionate about things that I do.
Sure.
And to make a lot of the things happen, I've had to really just stand by. Once in a while, I have backed down because there have been good reasons. But generally, if I feel something isn't going to happen, I work pretty hard to make it happen.
Sure.
Yema ya se su
I actually want to talk a little more about Spirits of Havana a little later. But one thing I was curious, did you get your sense of humor from your mother?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
my mother's 97.
Wow.
And she still makes me laugh, you know. She still has a sense of the ironic.
Mm.
She's deeply, you know, people always say to me, oh, you know, what's your religion? And I say, well, I think it has to be sarcasm and cynicism. Because I have a real sense of irony, and my mother does. And I don't know. I kind of feel like there's no way you can get through life without it. Being that way has helped me look on the brighter sides of things, you know.
Your mother had mentioned that you had wanted to be a concert pianist. So how did you make the switch from piano to soprano sax?
Well, that was pretty easy. The writing on the wall was there was no way I was going to be a concert pianist. I dabbled all my life between art and music. I went to 5 high schools, so that gives you a sense of sort of my academic outlook. And when I did decide that I really wanted to do music, I dropped out of school, and I was probably about 17, and I was really working hard at piano, and I'd always been a bit of a quitter. When I got deep into something and it got really difficult, I worked really diligently when I felt that I'd finally kind of figured out what I wanted to do. And by doing that, I wrecked my hand with tendonitis. I was playing not in a good position at the piano, and I was not taking breaks. You know, a little voice in my head would just not say, okay, it's time to take, you know, 20 minutes off and stop playing. And I did this repeatedly because I was going then for my grade 10 piano, which is kind of a high level of piano. The next thing after the grade 10 is your certificate for teaching. So I was working away at that, and it was classical music. But I did like to get together with my friends sometimes on the weekends and pick up a flute that I had somehow gotten and noodle away on it. So I was playing classical music all week and studying. And then on the weekends, you know, somebody would come over with a guitar and somebody else had bongos. And we would just kind of jam and have fun and drink beer and, you know, do everything else and just have fun with music. So there was this other part of me that really liked the collective social aspect of music. Make long story short, I did wreck my hand, and I was going to have an operation. Was seeing various doctors, and one of the doctors suggested that I just take, you know, a good 6 weeks off of the piano and get away from the piano, because it was too tempting to be around it, and go somewhere warm. So I did go to San Francisco with my cousin, and it was there sort of the penny dropped, kind of my first time away from home, like as an adult, you know, traveling around. And we had a great club here in Toronto called the Colonial, where many of the greats came through. My older brother was a big jazz fan, and we would go to a matinee if it was Mose Allison, Mingus, I saw a number of times there, Ross on Roland Kurt, Horace Silver. I saw like a lot of matinees there, and when I got a little older, some evening shows. So I had some exposure to jazz, and I loved it, but I never really saw myself. I just didn't. My upbringing, being a woman, and all these things, I just never even considered that I would play jazz. So here I am in San Francisco, and I'm about, at this point, I think I was 19, maybe not quite 20. I saw Mingus was playing at Keystone Corners, and coincidentally enough, Don Pullen was in the band at the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, who I later played with. Really blew my mind, because here I was watching this band, and I went one night, and I went back the next night, and I went back the next night. I think they were there 5 nights with George Adams, Danny Richman, Jack Walrus. And opening up every night was Phineas Newborn.
Oh, wow.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I knew who Mingus was, but I didn't know who Phineas Newborn was. When I came back from that trip, I had pretty much made up my mind that I wanted to play jazz. I didn't know how to go about doing it. That's a kooky story, how I finally fell into meeting some people that were playing jazz and stuff. But I thought, I'm a woman, I'm white, I'm from a middle upper class family. I don't fit what the definition is of a jazz musician. But I still really loved it, and I wanted to do it. So this was kicking around. But I pretty much knew that I was not going to be a classical piano player. And also, too, I think when I saw just what was happening on that stage, the interaction over a few nights with Mingus's group, I just thought, this has to be the ultimate. You know, these people that are making this music, they're so deep into it. It really hit me.
Thank you.
about Jane Fair? Who is she, and what has she meant to you?
Yeah, well, Jane Fair was, and still is, a saxophone player. And when I met her, she was probably one of the few women that was out here on the scene in Toronto playing. She wasn't playing a whole lot, but she was playing as much as she could, because it was pretty hard. You know, it's competitive. The guys take a lot of the gigs, and she later became a mom and had a family, but she was at this place that I just took an accidental walk home one time, because I was mulling about, how am I going to learn how to play jazz? There's no place to go. How am I going to do it? Listening to records? I don't know. And I saw this house, and it said the New School of Music, and I walked up the stairs, and I said, what is this place? And they said, well, we're a school, and we teach improvising. I said, really? And he said, yeah, you know, we're all jazz musicians, and this guy, Howard Spring, I said, I've set up this school. I'm putting together workshops on Saturdays and Sundays, and then I've got a few people here that come in this house, and there's like five rooms here, and somebody goes and teaches saxophone there, and there's piano down here, and they were just getting going. It was really amazing. So I began taking, I guess it was jazz flute, and I enrolled in some jazz piano, and then I took a workshop, and I just started hanging out at this place, and then going out with all the people in my workshop, and going to clubs, and hanging out in record stores, and that sort of set me on my course of jazz investigation and loving it and really having fun. And then I met Jane Fair, who started teaching there, and she was really, really great. She still is a wonderful player. She hasn't hit the pavement as much as me. She's gone more into the academia world, and she teaches a lot of young people. She puts together workshops for younger kids, like they're like 14, 15. She's connected to college here that has an outreach, and so she's been doing that, and she's a marvelous teacher. She really sort of set me straight. I did a couple years with her, and then later we formed a group that was called Music in Monk Time, and then I was just like studying the music of Monk, and then shortly after that, this is like in about 1991, I headed off to Paris to study with Steve Lacy, just a few years after I picked up the soprano sax. I set my goals pretty high, and I try and achieve them, and off I went. I was like, okay, I'm going to see if I could study with Steve Lacy, and
wow.
He was coming to Toronto here and there, and I started hanging out the sound checks with him, because that's the horn I really gravitated towards. I have a tenor, and our house became sort of a mecca for visiting musicians. If a musician was playing in town, well, I would go out to their sound check. I'd hang out at their shows, for example, Clifford Jordan or
wow.
Barry Harris.
Wow.
A number of different players, and say, hey, let's do some workshops at our house. So they come over on their afternoons off, and I would do some workshops here in the house. So I'm sort of diverting, but Jane was really somebody who really set me out on a great course, because she has a great sound on the horn and was extremely encouraging. And even in times when I didn't have money to take a lesson, she said, I don't care about that. Just come over and let's work on some stuff. You know?
Excellent. That's wonderful. And then you met Larry. Larry Kramer.
Then I met Larry.
Trumpeter.
I met Larry at this funny school I was telling you about, which was like kind of a private school. First time I met him, I really took such a disliking to the guy. People tell me that happens. You know, you end up like marrying somebody, falling in love with somebody, and on your first impression of them was not good. But he was a real heckler, and he was giving the guy at the music school a hard time and kind of like really needling the guy. And I thought, why is this guy just bugging this guy so much? And all these quirky things about Larry, that they were actually quite endearing and pretty funny. And shortly after that, when I enrolled at York University in the jazz program, lo and behold, I found out that he was in my ethnomusicology class.
Oh, wow.
And it was just like, oh, my God, not you. Then one day we both showed up. This guy was the worst, the most fascinating subject in the world, was made the most awful, boring, driest subject in the world by this professor. And we arrived at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we were both late for the class, and the lecture had already started, and we looked at each other outside the lecture hall and said, do you want to go? No, I don't want to go. Do you want? I don't want to go either. So boring. We started talking. Said, let's go for a coffee. We basically spent the whole day together, and that was that.
Oh,
and after that, we were partners, and that's probably about 1977.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
Yeah, a long time.
And you've worked together for so long as well.
We've had groups together, and he's been the producer pretty much of all the recordings.
And he's played on a lot of the recordings.
Yep, and a lot of the recordings have been sort of his idea. And to be totally honest with you, is that he was really the one that came up with the idea to form this all-woman group that I did. It came from him. And he's still kind of laughing about it. But he said, I didn't realize I produced myself out of the band. And I'm relegated to driving the van with all you chicks in it.
Oh, gosh. going to make my way to Makeke really soon.
Sure.
There's some other stuff I want to cover. Namely, you mentioned it earlier, working with Don Pullen. And we talked to Milford Graves during the last program, and he also worked with Don Pullen. What was it like?
Sure.
How did you manage to get Don Pullen and Dewey Redmond to work with you?
Well, that's another person who said I was pretty persistent, and that was Don, too.
Mm.
You are so persistent. I remember him saying it just like that. I met Don, I think the year would have been 1984 or 85, and Dewey around the same time. And I was a huge fan. When I met Larry, Larry was working at one of the local big store here called Sam the Record Man's, which would be like a J&R.
Okay.
Really, really huge jazz section in the store. So he was one of the main guys in the jazz section. And when I went back to his place and saw his wonderful record collection, it was like, wow, I had no idea there was just so much music out there. And one of the first records he played me, and I'd already knew Don Pullen through Mingus's group, but I didn't know Don on his own. He played me a record, a solo record that Don made on Sackville Records, and that sort of became one of the records that we dated to because it was just a very beautiful record. And he also introduced me to Dewey Redmond through Ornette's Old and New Dreams, stuff with Ornette. So I really became a huge fan of both of theirs. That summer of 85, Don Pullen was here in Toronto doing a solo piano concert at a place called Café des Copains, and I went over the course of a few nights, and I was starting to think about making my first record. I was just formed a group with Larry, and we were doing a tiny bit of playing. We were thinking about doing our first record, and Larry's idea, and my idea too, which I thought was great, was, you know, let's have a special guest on the record. So I thought about Don. I thought, well, man, if I could ever get Don on, because I loved his playing so much. When I played music, too, I always sort of tended to love the composers that were somewhat jazz-like and even sometimes had sort of that Latin tinge, Spanish feeling. I could kind of hear those kind of things in Don's playing. And then we thought, well, you know, if we can't get Don, the other person that would be amazing would be Dewey. So we thought about that, too. And then Dewey came and he did a duet concert with Charlie Hayden, which was just a beautiful concert. So it was within the same course of the jazz festival, 10-day festival here in Toronto. So I went and met Don, and I gave him my cassette that I had made with some of my music. I was just starting to write some tunes. I think I had about 5 tunes on it, and gave it to him, and he said he'd think about it, and he was really nice. And then I got his phone number. And then, also, I always laugh about meeting Dewey, because as soon as Dewey left the bandstand, it was like the green room was down below the concert, and I went roaring down. You know, I was the first person down there, because, you know, there's always the hangers-oners that want to say hi. Hangers-oners like me.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be the first hanger-oner in the room.
Right.
And Dewey was so funny, and he was like, oh, yeah, I can tell you're a musician. And, you know, I said, I play soprano sax and flute, and I'm doing my first record. Would you ever consider him playing it? And he said, yeah, oh, yeah, sure, I'll consider playing on your record, yeah. So I gave him a cassette. Then he was really nice. So they both got cassettes, and then there was the follow-up, and the follow-up was like quite a few phone calls, and I kept missing Don. At this time, I was going with Larry. We were jumping on the bus and coming down, and we were studying with Barry Harris at his workshop. So we'd take the bus, come down for the weekend, and when I would come down, I would call and leave messages for Don, and of course he was on the road or whatever. But finally I got him, and I think I was like being my pleading self, and I was like, oh, the time's approaching. And he picked up the phone, and he said, well, you know what? I really like your music. It's really nice. Yeah. He said, you're so persistent, aren't you? And I was like, yep. And he said, yes. And then we just got down to the fine details. And then I'm like, what the hell? I could have pursued Dewey, too. And then Dewey said yes, too. It was just like a dream come true. And so we did a show here in Toronto at a club. And then we went and did this live off the floor. I can't remember if it was in 1 or 2 days or just all in one day. But I did my first record in due time.
Right. I was wondering whether everybody was in the room for that.
Yep. That was like live off the floor.
No
stage. There was no mixing. It was just bang, do it.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for October 16th. This segment features aerial listings of Suge and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show features flutist and saxophonist Jane Bennett. She's at Birdland with Makeke on the 25th for the 8:30 and 11 p.m. sets. And right now, I usually go into the shows of the week, and we'll do that in a minute, but WBAI needs your support to stay on the air and keep us on the air. So we ask that you call 516-620-3602, preferably while we're on the air. That's 516-620-3602, or you can pledge online at give2wbai.org, and we've got that linked on our website and blog. You can pledge as little as $5 to the station, or consider becoming a sustaining member with a monthly pledge. And for a $35 pledge to the station, you can get a copy of Bennett's brand new CD, Odara, that you're hearing tonight, and that includes a year's station membership. We'll repeat the info at the bottom of the segment, but right now we'll go to our music listings. We start with Trio 3 with saxophonist Oliver Lake, bassist Reggie Workman, and drummer Andrew Surreal. They're at Roulette in Brooklyn for the Passin' Through Festival on the 17th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 19th. Trombonist Craig Harris is at Harlem's Rendell Memorial Presbyterian Church on the 21st and 28th. Saxophonist David Murray joins him as a special guest on the 28th. Details are at harlemjazzbox.com. That's harlemjazzbox.com, and box has three X's. Pianist Vijay Iyer will be at the McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey on the 21st, and Columbia University's Miller Theater on the 22nd. Vocalist Catherine Russell is at the McCarter Theater on the 22nd. Drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun is at Applehead Recording in Saugerties, New York for a session with guitarist Vernon Reed's Zigzag Power Trio, and that's on the 22nd. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria is at the Bronx Music Heritage Center for a Latin jazz tribute to the poetry of Edgar Allan Poe on the 22nd. Saxophonist Ahmed Abdullah leads his Diaspora Ensemble at Brooklyn's Sister's Place on the 22nd. Drummer Roy Haynes is at the Blue Note on the 24th to the 25th. Vocalist Kurt Elling is at Birdland celebrating the release of his The Beautiful Day CD from the 26th through the 29th. Also at the Blue Note is saxophonist Kenny Garrett, and he's part of pianist Chick Corea's Miles Davis tribute from the 26th through the 30th. Pianist and keyboardist Mark Carey hosts the Harlem Sessions at Ginny's Supper Club in Manhattan on the 27th. Vocalist Renee Marie is at the Jazz Standard from the 27th through the 30th. Pianist Muhal Richard Abrams is at the Community Church of New York in Manhattan on the 28th to wrap up the AACM New York Chapter's Fall Concert Series. Low brass specialist on tuba, Joe Daly, will be at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 29th. Finally, drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun's gallery exhibit of his visual art collaboration, Azza, continues at the Bronx Music Heritage Center through February 11th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Suga is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you see something good, we'd appreciate likes, tweaks, and shares with your friends. Again, to help us out in this fall fun drive, call 516-620-3602, preferably while we're on the air, or pledge online at give2wbai.org, and a $35 pledge will get you a copy of the brand new Jane Bennett Odara CD that you're hearing tonight, along with a year's station membership. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, October 30th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand. Mm-hmm.
This is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Thank you.
Now it's time to talk about Spirits of Havana. Guillermo Barreto Brown, he was born 1929, he transitioned in 1991. Tell us about him.
Wow, you know, all these people, and I look back, I've just been so lucky with the people that I've met. I really wouldn't change anything with just the course of the musicians that I've had the chance to hook up with, and he's another one that just lines right up there with Don and Dewey and everybody. He was probably one of the most disciplined musicians in Cuba. He loved jazz. He loved Joe Jones.
The drummer.
And yeah, and if you look at some of the footage of Guillermo playing, he looks exactly like him when he plays. Yeah. He must have seen footage himself. I don't think he ever met him. But he was the drummer of choice for people like Nat King Cole and Sarah Vaughan and a lot of the greats before the revolution. And all the jazz musicians were coming to the Sans Souci and the Riviera and all these clubs. He was the drummer of choice. And at that time, you know, there was still very serious racial barriers. And many of the American musicians that came insisted, like Nat King Cole would not play with any other drummer except Guillermo. And even though other drummers were, oh, what about this guy? And he was like, no, I want Guillermo. Guillermo had an incredible sense of swing, and he just loved jazz so much, and he loved the harmony, and he loved sitting down at the piano, and just the whole scene. And but he also was a music teacher, very, very strict percussion teacher, and he failed a lot of people, so he had a lot of enemies. In Cuba, if you fail a student, you're basically screwed. And he was a decision maker for many people if they were going to go have careers in music or not. So he was a tough guy, but he was an incredible friend to us. And he also understood a lot about the Afro-Cuban music. That's when Mercedes comes in. He was married to Mercedes. They were married many, many years, and Mercedes was not only one of the great interpreters of the Afro-Cuban folkloric music, but the Afro-Cuban popular music. So she straddled both worlds, and so she did, you know, she did the nightclubs, but she also did a lot of the ceremonies, and she was not only the first woman, but the first artist, period, to go over live radio in Havana, Cuba, singing for the Orishas.
Wow.
And there was quite a big backlash for many of the practitioners of that music when she did that. She went at the insistence of Fernando Ortiz, who was one of the great musicologists there, and very highly respected, and he put her on air, and there was like a lot of repercussions from that, because number one, I think they wanted to maybe keep the music secret. They didn't know how people were going to respond to it, as all of this voodoo or nonsense, and they felt, you know, a lot of that was private. She really wanted to sing the praise of the music, and she went ahead and did that.
So wait, she did this before Celia Cruz was doing it?
She was, the difference would be is that she stayed and Celia Cruz left.
Okay.
And she continued to do that, and Celia Cruz went on to this incredible, unbelievable career.
Sure.
Mercedes made maybe one trip to the Apollo Theater.
Oh.
Maybe she made two trips to the U.S., and on her third possible trip, which I think was supposed to be at the Lincoln Center, it was either at the Lincoln Center or Symphony Space, she was to perform with Yoruba and Dabo, who was the group that she brought them into the fold. She was the one who got them registered for our recording as musicians. And so she started touring with them, too, to Columbia and places. And she gave those guys their, they were due to get some respect, of course. She made a lot of things happen. And an unfortunate thing that did happen in the end was that on the third visit that was supposed to be to the U.S. with Mercedes and Yoruba and Dabo, I can't exactly remember where she performed, but they considered her a popular singer, and they said, we're not allowing her into the U.S.
Oh, my goodness.
Yoruba and Dabo can come in under the cultural auspices that they're doing some cultural diaspora. And in Mercedes' case, it was like, you just came back from Colombia and made money, and so you're not coming here.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so she was banned. She did not get a visa for the U.S. She was devastated because her star was starting to rise, and she sort of basically said to the group, you're not going without me. And they were like, yeah, we are. And off they went, because, you know, of course they needed the income, they needed the money, and these are the sad things that happened. So in 1983, we started to become very good friends with Guillermo and Mercedes, and visited them a lot in Cuba. And we started to plan this record, I guess, about 1987. Let's do a record. And we started to work towards that. And they really became, I mean, there was a generational gap there. But we never felt it. When I met them, we were in our very early 30s, I guess, and they would have been in their 60s, 70s, 60s. So they were quite a bit older than us, but we never felt it. But at the same time, Mercedes really took me under her wing in terms of, like, showing me the music, teaching me about the religion. Guillermo was the same way, much more so with the Cuban popular music and the clave, like making
right.
sure, you know, understood that. And that Spirits of Havana record never would have happened without those two, because I did not realize, and I sure respect it now, that I was being introduced to two of the most important people in Cuba that I could ever meet.
Right.
Yep.
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl is the name of this program. I didn't get to mention this earlier, but I'll let you know what you've heard. What you're listening to right now is Epistrophe from Jane Burnett. That's from Spirits of Havana. Before that, we heard Yamaya, also from Spirits of Havana. Spirits of Havana was originally released in 1992 on Denon Records. This is a 2016 reissue, the 25th anniversary edition on Linus Records. Before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment. Before that, we heard The Wanderer. That is Jane Burnett from her debut release as a leader, In Due Time, featuring Don Pullen and Dewey Redman. That's a 1988 Dark Light Music release. Before that, we heard from the Adara release, which is what we're offering this evening for a pledge of $35 if you call 516-620-3602. What we heard from that release is Café Pilon. Before that, we heard Donna Lee from Jane Burnett's Alma de Santiago. That's a 2001 Blue Note Records release. Before that, we heard Dream from Odara. Before that, we heard Yamaya from Spirits of Havana. And before that, we heard El Chivo from Odara.
And of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, and that's from the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. That's a RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. As mentioned, for a pledge of $35, you can receive Odara, the latest from Jane Burnett and Makeke. And you can get this by going to give2wbai.org or calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or give2wbai.org. Sugar My Bowl continues.
It's been 25 years. This year marked the 25th anniversary, and there was a two-disc edition that was released earlier this year.
Yes. The first one is the record from 1990.
Right.
And that has Gonzalo Rubalcaba on it, and Hilario Duran, Frank Emilio, the late Frank Emilio, Yoruba Ndabo. Mm-hmm. Many of the people have passed away now. Mercedes, Guillermo, Roberto Garcia. Oh,
wow.
God, there's a long list. Mm-hmm. And then the other record that's on it is called Chamalongo, which is an all-star record that was made 1995-96. We were making that record on the bottom floor of the Grim. Ryder Cooter was making the Social Club Buena Vista record.
Oh, wow.
Above our heads at the same time that was
that's
happening.
That's so funny. Oh, my goodness.
And our record was like an all-star record with Rumberos from Havana, Tatawines.
Mm-hmm.
It was Mercedes' last recording.
Okay. And Yosvani Terry was on that one.
Thank you.
Adios, Fanny Terry.
Yeah.
So that was his first recording.
Wow.
Oh, my God, I keep remembering that. That was Adios, Fanny's first record.
Well, actually, there are a lot of people who came out of that project, and your recordings in general, like Adios, Fanny Terry, saxophonist. Now, Gonzalo Rubicalo, was he already big when he came to you?
Yeah, he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was big. Not as big as he is now, of course,
right.
But he was really on the cusp just shortly after that. I think he started working with, I think his record came out on Mesador, Mi Gran Pasión, which is one of the best records of all time. Beautiful record. He was living at the time, I think he was still living in Cuba, but he was spending a lot of time, I think, in Santo Domingo. So he was starting to travel a fair bit, and we were just really lucky that he was in Cuba at that time and able to do that recording. Yeah.
And Hilario Duran came out of your...
Yeah, that was the first time I met Hilario. That was a really freaky thing because Hilario almost wasn't on the record because it was one of those things. He had worked, he'd probably done over 500 records for EGRAM. He was sort of like the first call pianist for anything that happened at the EGRAM studio,
wow.
Which is the national studio.
Mm-hmm.
So he was backing Omara and all the big names and making all these recordings and doing a lot of work with Guillermo. And when we sat down with Guillermo and started to decide, we said we really need to have a piano player who's got a great sense of harmony and loves jazz, but really also loves the Afro-Cuban music. Because a lot of people at that time, we were meeting piano players, but at that time, fusion was really predominant in Cuba, Chick Corea and Dave Weckl and that kind mm-hmm. of sound. Keyboard and, you know, like fusion, you know, when I
right.
say rock fusion, that's what
sure.
people sort of liked. You had to search out the Afro-Cuban music.
Wow.
And especially the folkloric music, because it was very marginalized music. So we wanted a piano player that loved that music because they were going to be playing with bata and we were going to be incorporating Yoruba and Dabo with Afro-Cuban chants and et cetera, et cetera. And Guillermo said, I have just the guy for you. Great. And I'll get him. So when we finally get to Cuba, we're there a few days before the session. And I only found out just a few years ago from Hilario, because now he lives here in Toronto. We were talking and he said for the longest time his English was not very good. But he finally told me the story because he could explain it. He said, you know, I did not know that I was on your session until the day of the session.
Wow.
And I ran to Guillermo on the street, and Guillermo said to me, oh, I've been looking for you. We have a session today. You got to meet these two Canadians that are coming. We have a session today, and it starts at such and such a time.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
And that's the only way Hilario heard.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it when Hilario told me that. I said, are you kidding me? That's
wow.
true? So it was destiny, I guess.
Well, another pianist that's been in your projects, and rather frequently, I noticed, David Viriles.
Thank you.
David Reyes, David, yep. We're very, very proud of David.
He's been playing with Henry Threadgill among doing
his
other projects.
Yeah, he's playing with Henry. Well, it's funny because I think I can pretty much say this, that he discovered Henry Threadgill in my house.
Okay.
Yeah, because, well, what happened, David, like I mentioned, my husband, Larry, has a huge record collection.
Uh-huh.
And one of my favorite groups was Air. And
I
used to come to New York, I often used to love to go hear them play. So back in 2001, maybe 2002, I won an award in Toronto called the Toronto Mayor's Awards. And they pick a musician, they pick somebody from literature, they pick somebody from theater. There's about 7 or 8 awards, and it's, you know, it's a couple of thousand dollars, and you are to pick a protege and commission something. And I had just met David in Santiago de Cuba on one of my trips there, because we work in that, we take instruments down to Cuba and for the conservatories and try and help with this. So I met him, and I played with him, and he was very, very good, and I was like, he was just 14 at the time.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, this kid's really, really good. And when I came back to Toronto, I found that I had received this award, and I asked them, because it was normally supposed to go to somebody who was here in your own city. And I said, look, I've met this young kid, and I'd like to bring him to Toronto and send him out for a few lessons, and I'll commission him to write me a piece of music. And so that's what I did with the money. So he came, he was just to come here for 2 weeks. That was in May, and he ended up staying into June. We sent him to jazz camp.
Oh, wow.
And then after that, he stayed. We got him enrolled in a music. Some friends of mine, very good friends, paid for his tuition. He made it into the university.
Nice.
The next thing, he was living here in our house, and he was living here for a good 5 years, four or five years. And then he got to the point where it was like, we had Henry's records here. He was starting to like the music. And then he went out on his own. He got his own place in Toronto and started teaching at the college, too.
Oh, wow.
And then he put forth a grant to go study with Henry, and he got it. And so that's what landed him in New York. Now he's playing with Thomas Stankel and Ravi Coltrane, Chris Potter, Tom Harrell, and Henry, and Dunreal.
And he's in New York.
I pinched myself because I went to hear him at the Vanguard with his own group, and then I called him the next day when I was there. I said, I had this crazy dream. I was at the Vanguard, and you were playing. So we're very proud of David. He's a remarkable musician and just a beautiful kid. He's not a kid anymore.
But I guess you can still refer to him as a kid because you knew him since he was one.
I've seen him put maple syrup on his waffles, you know? Which is a half-an-hour process.
Oh, my goodness. Also, drummers Daphnis Pietro.
Right.
And Pedrito Martinez. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pedrito played on Michelle Rosewoman's projects as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was in New Yoruba. He played with you before he played with her?
Yeah.
Okay.
He ended up in New York because he's in Spirits of Havana for quite a few years, and we were playing SOBs. He met his future wife at SOBs that night. He's on Chamelongo, too. Yeah, he played with me for a long time, and then he stayed in New York. I can't remember which tour it was, what year it was, but he stayed in New York when the rest of the musician came back. He was going to stay a little longer, and he called like 4 in the morning at the border at Niagara Falls to say he couldn't do it, couldn't go back to Cuba, and he was going to stay. I remember that phone call very well. I remember just thinking, oh, no, Pedrito, don't worry, you know, you got to go back, don't worry, we'll get you out again, and he said, no, you don't understand, I just can't, I've met this woman, I can't, and he was at the border, he was going to do it, and then as soon as he just got there, he turned around and went back. Some friends were driving him. We were going to pick him up, and then, you know, he was going to go back with the rest of the Cubans, Pancho Quinto and Ernesto Gatel, who's now in Washington. Mm-hmm. They call him El Gato, and he's pretty much the last person that left Cuba. Amado is still in Cuba. All these guys were on our recordings and working with us. So Pedrito stayed, and then shortly after that, things really started happening. I mean, he won the Thelonious Monk competition. It was the first year for percussion.
Wow.
We were all very proud. Pancho Quinto, who was sort of one of the very
important people in my Spirits of Havana, or elder, I guess we'll call them. Pedrito was mentored by Pancho as a young musician, and I just remember we were all pretty much jumping up and down when he won that prize. He was very diligent. I remember even on the road, you know, when we were traveling, he was trying to learn how to read music, because he's a musician from the streets.
Right.
He learned the music, you know, just how that music is passed on.
Exactly.
But he really wanted to be able to understand, you know, notation and be able to make arrangements, and everybody was kind of showing him things and stuff like that. So he's really hardworking, and we're really proud of what he's done too. And I'm glad to see he's like, you know, he's just all over New York. So he's doing just fine. He's an incredible talent. I mean, his voice, I remember the first time I heard him. I met him with Mercedes. We were doing a rehearsal, and we were preparing, I think it was for the Chamolongo record, and he was playing percussion, so I knew him primarily as a percussionist, and then he opened his mouth and started singing, and the sound, like, you know, when you hear somebody sing without a microphone and project in that way, he just had this just beautiful, beautiful voice.
Yes. Oh, the first time I heard it, it was like, oh my goodness, it's like the sky opened up or something.
No, it really is. It's like, it's hard to describe that kind of voice, because it's very, it's so clear and clean, and, and it's edgy, but at the same time it's really full.
Yes.
Like, it's got such a full body sound, and it's just, oh, it's just beautiful. Yeah, he's really gifted.
speaking of people who have come out of your projects, now you have a project. And you mentioned earlier how Larry talked himself out of a job.
Yeah.
Now you have an all-woman project.
Now I'm just the bus driver.
Jane Bonetta and Makeke. So tell us about the lineup.
Well, that whole group started because I had taken a whole bunch of tourists down to Cuba, and I was in Havana, and it was for the jazz festival, and I'd organized a jam session at the hotel that we were all staying in, all these Canadian tourists, and it was in a cigar bar, and I met Daimi Arocena in the lobby of the hotel, and
now, what is she?
You know, she's a singer, and she's going great guns right now. If you Google her, Daimi, D-A-Y-M-E, Arocena, A-R-O-C-E-N-A. She's now hooked up with Giles Peterson at Brownswood Records. And so she's since working with me. I met her and I said, hey, you know, come up. I'm doing a jam session. Love to hear you sing. So she came up and she was very, very good. And she was very feisty. And I thought, wow. And she had a terrific presence and voice. So that got the wheel sort of turning. I was involved in doing a show here in Toronto for a woman's shelter called Sistering. And they do a fundraiser every year, and I'm the musical director of that. And there's like usually four or five singers. And so I convinced them. I said, you know, I met this singer in Cuba. She's 17 years old, and she's very, very good. And I'd love to bring her up because, you know, we have a whole new ethnic group now in Toronto. Like, there's many Spanish-speaking people here now, which there never was. Everyone used to just go to the U.S. And so there's much more Spanish-speaking people in Toronto and Portuguese and everywhere. So,
okay.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of women at risk that had not been settled so easily here.
Oh.
So I convinced them to give me the budget to bring Daimi from Cuba, and I put her in the show. And here was this 17-year-old that brought the roof down. You know, there was a number of other singers on the show that are very well known. She was not known, and she got standing ovations.
Wow.
And shortly after that, Larry said to me, what would happen? Why don't you think about putting a group together with Daimi? And then that's when it happened. I went back to Cuba. We scouted around, and we assembled this group, which is now Makeke. And so I met Magdalie Savigny, who is from Santiago de Cuba, who was now living in Havana. She's on percussion and vocals. And I met Dana Olano, who was a classical pianist who really loved jazz. And I checked out various people, and this is the group that we assembled that we thought would work. So Dana Olano's on piano and vocals. Jissy Garcia, who I knew about because she was playing in a group with Roberto Cacases and Talmari Diaz, which is called, and I'm doing a blank right now on the group. Jissy's a drummer, and her father is one of the great Cuban drummers, Bernardo Garcia, who played with Arturo Sandoval and Paquito and Irakere and all the groups.
Wow.
So she was a little bit more well-known. Who am I missing now?
Cecilia?
Celia Jimenez,
who's
from Matanzas, Cuba. She was actually a classical bassoonist who had only just picked up the bass guitar just 2 or 3 years.
Oh, wow.
She was at the music school, ANA, and she saw this other woman that was playing an electric bass, and she was like, hey, I'd like to try it. And in fact, she didn't own one when I made the first Makeke record. She borrowed a broken bass, which I probably spent about $1,000 trying to correct the sound after I found out that she was recording on a broken bass.
Oh, no.
Oh, God. Thanks for telling me. And she's on vocals. And then we've added into the mix Melba Santa from, she was in the group.
Oh, the vocalist.
And, yeah. So Melba's is in the group now. And she's amazing. And Elizabeth Rodriguez, who's on violin and vocals.
Are all of these members going to be at Birdland?
Yes.
On the 25th?
Will be at, yep, on, everyone will be at Birdland.
Yay!
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Is that two sets, by the way?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. How has it been? Because I remember talking, and I don't know whether you want to, you just tell me, no, we're not going to cover that. When we had spoken about this date at Birdland, it wasn't quite certain that it was going to happen. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, the thing was that Kurt Elling couldn't do a gig, so that's why I got it. You know, it's so... Can I say the word
No.
Hard to get a gig in New York?
No, find a better way.
It's really difficult.
There you go.
It's very difficult to get a gig in New York. I'm not on the scene, and I just know it's difficult for everybody, right? I mean, I played at the Jazz Standard, and I played at what was Sweet Rhythm, and mm-hmm. What else have I played? I played Blue Note. Blue Note was great, but it all comes down to timing, too. The CD's out October 14, and Chicoria, I think the whole month was Chicoria, so I couldn't get back into Blue Note, and then there was this date that came free, because luckily Kurt Elling couldn't do it. We got that night, so we're just hoping we really get the word out, because I'd love to be able to be back there. You know, if we do well, we will be back there.
So the recording, how were these selections selected?
Well, that's kind of the exciting thing for me, because the first record, most of the music was written by Dime, myself, and then the record got a Juno, and that's Juno's like your Grammy,
right,
in the States. I think that kind of pumped up everybody's creative juices, and that now everybody is writing in the group. So the new record...
Well, actually, I wasn't aware that this was the second. I thought this was the first.
No!
Shocker!
Importantly, for the second one, everybody's writing in the group now. So the group has really, like, from where we were 2 years ago to where we are now is like night and day. 3 years ago, the group is just kick-ass. I'm really, really excited, and we can't wait to get to New York, and I think we're going to blow people's minds. The group is really, really, really strong.
So even though everybody's writing, how did you select from everybody's writing?
Well, some stuff didn't make it, but that's just how it goes. Might make it to the next recording. You know, we just assembled a good flow of combination of all of our things, and I always like to have a really good balance of stuff that's like incorporates Afro-Cuban, some folkloric input, but at the same time as jazz, because to me it is still all about improvising too. And firstly, I call myself a jazz musician who incorporates Cuban idiom into the music.
So is there something you want to tell us before we wrap this up?
Wow, I feel like you've just taken me on a This Is Your Life.
Exactly.
It's really, I'm kind of sitting here red-faced talking about this all, but I just feel so fortunate to have had all these people in my life, and it's all very meaningful and special. Thanks, Joyce, for your time, and it's been really great speaking, and I just really, really hope people come out to Birdland just to let folks know that I petitioned to come into the U.S., even though Obama made that beautiful speech and everything. It's still not so easy for the Cubans. We have to petition to come into the U.S. and get permission and get the petition approved, and then, of course, get the visas. And that's all been done, even though they're not here in Toronto yet. They'll be here in a couple days. But we are only allowed one entrance into the U.S. And so when we come there for the one night, we're there for the one night, and then we're gone. And when we come back to Canada, they go back to Cuba, we won't be back for quite some time. So you got to catch us this one night at Birdland, or you won't get us.
Oh, you definitely should come out. That one night is Tuesday, October 25th. There are two sets, 8:30 and 11. Doors open at 7:30. So show up. Be there Tuesday, October 25th. I certainly plan to be there, so I look forward to seeing you again, Jane Bonnet.
Well, thanks. Thanks so much. It's been really great speaking with you.
And have a good night.
Yeah, thank you.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening, Jane Bonnet. And we've been featuring her latest CD with Jane Bonnet and Makeke. That is on Linus Records. We've been offering it this evening for a pledge of $35. You can get this CD by calling 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Or by going to give2wbai.org. give2wbai.org. What we're listening to right now is La Flamenca Maria. As mentioned, it is from Makeke. Before this, Tres Golpes Pa Legua, which is also from Odara. Before that, we heard Lagrimas Negra from Jane Bonnet's Alma de Santiago. And before that, we heard Freedom at Last from Jane Bonnet's Chumalongo, which features Yosvani Terry. This was his debut release, recorded release as a sideman. That's Connector Music 2000. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. We'll be back on October 30th. But check us out at Sugar My Bowl www.mercedesmusic.org for our On the Bandstand segment. We still keep that going when we aren't here. Don't forget to call 516-620-3602 or go to give2wbai.org. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.